one?
JP Morgan Chase. And in addition to them being one of the biggest bailed out banks, they also, in 2011, admitted that they wrongly overcharged thousands of military families for their mortgages, including active duty personnel in Afghanistan. Bank also admitted it improperly foreclosed on more than a dozen military families. Both actions were in clear violation of the Service Members Civil Relief Act, which automatically lowers mortgage rates to 6% and bars foreclosure proceedings of active duty personnel. JP Morgan Chase, everybody.
So now that people's homes are getting foreclosed on, and they won't adapt their loans so that they can get a better price and actually stay in their house, now they're contemplating bulk sales of all the foreclosed homes, like the big banks and stuff, so that they can lend, so that they can become renters, so they can become, you know, tenant, rent, landlord, overlords over big populations of people. So what they're doing is, now, is they won't give you a deal to stay in your house. But if you lose your house, they're gonna sell it at half price to the banks. If the banks can buy 500 at a time, and then we can all rent from the banks. It'd be awesome.
As we continue to cover the Occupy movement, this past week, the 99% gathered for the first time for a national conference in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to talk about the movement and its future. Among those traveling to this convergence was Indy Media's own V. Not even a car breakdown in Tennessee could keep her and other Houston occupiers from participating. She brings us this report from the week's actions and events.
I'm here to talk about Independence Day. To me, all these celebrations around us in the city are a lie. Our founding fathers do not represent me. They declared independence for themselves. They're the land-owning gentry here in these colonies, and they declared it for themselves from the British monarchy. Their Declaration of Independence did not include women. It did not free the slave. It did not recognize the caretakers of this land, the indigenous people. The history of freedom and liberation that this day represents is false. To me, this is the farce of July.
TC's elections saw a number of firsts beyond the re-election of the first African-American president, Barack Obama. In 2012, marked the first openly gay female senator winning an election. Democrat Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, Colorado, and Washington became the first states to legalize recreational marijuana use. Meanwhile, Montana and Colorado were the first states to pass anti-personhood laws for corporations. New Hampshire is the first state to have all women in top elected official positions, and Tuesday marked the first time gay marriage passed as a ballot measure. Mazie Hirano, also a Democrat, is the first Buddhist, first Asian American woman, and the first Japanese-born senator elected to public office. Hawaii made history twice on Tuesday by electing the first Hindu to Congress, 31-year-old Iraq War veteran Tulsi Gabbard. With eight races in the House yet to be decided, 90% of the Republican seats are held by white men, compared with just 47% of Democratic seats.
I'm always excited to see the pageantry of the elections, just like I'm excited to see the pageantry of the Olympics, because it's so much pomp and circumstance, but a lot of empty air when it's all said and done. It's like eating a good candy bar, and once you're finished with it, you're like, wow, what did I just consume here? I felt great for a second, but now it's the big letdown, and the reality sets in. And so, I'm hoping that radicals, anarchists, left-leaning people, and progressives will continue to not only challenge the current administration, but all administrations that are elected into office, and that we'll continue to focus on building our power from below, not just in resisting, but also in creating more power for ourselves and exercising our power, because we're not trying to have a power over, but a power from below.
Right now that we're going and trying to bargain, there's
third contract and hoping to make additional improvements, because living with $9,000 a year really is not a livable wage for them. They're still having to make major sacrifices on a daily basis. And when I talk about that is, they're still having to sacrifice whether, do they pay rent this month and then leave without a phone or maybe not buy a full set of groceries because this is the beginning of the month and they have to pay rent. They really live day by day just getting by. But it turns out that that's probably the way that many, many other Houstonians live, because we just found out that, that's the reality not just for janitors, but for a lot of other workers. Because of the attacks that they were receiving at work, it made more sense to do the strikes the way we're doing them, where we're doing them in, the different buildings and with the owners who are actually breaking the law, for additional protection. That does not mean that this is the only thing that these workers are willing to do, or that it will always be just one building at a time. It's going to be whatever it takes.
Later in the week, Houston police arrested 15 protesters who blocked the downtown intersection of Smith and Bell on Wednesday. The protesters were there after they marched to show support for union janitors and were surrounded by about 250 protesters. Earlier today, Mayor Anise Parker issued a statement calling for the cleaning contractors to return to the negotiating table, saying their unwillingness to talk has left the union with no other choice but civil disobedience.
In Livingston, Texas, the Polk County Immigration Prison is one of the worst of our immigration gulags. It is a for-profit prison for immigrants awaiting their civil immigration hearing, who sleep 8 to a small cell for 23 hours a day, lack proper food and medical care, and are far from their families and lawyers. Over 100 people from Austin and Houston, Texas, came to Livingston, Texas on December 8, 2012, to protest the Polk County Immigration Prison.
I'm an undocumented immigrant from Mexico City. My A number is 200-594-535. And I was incarcerated at Gun Hutto on March 18, 2010. I was arrested for speaking out against police brutality in my community. And because of ESCOM, I was detained. I was put in detention in solitary confinement for 2 days prior to being moved to the Gun Hutto Detention Center. And since then, I've been organizing to shut down places like this, to shut down places where you're not a person but a number. To speak out about the injustices that occur inside, to speak about what the women want to be heard and what they need to be heard. So it means a lot to me as someone that was inside of those walls, being out here today with y'all in solidarity to make sure that people don't experience what it is to be in a detention center, to make sure that they have the rights as human beings, and to make sure that their voices are heard.
There's bad situations in there. They've got people in there working for a dollar a day, painting, mopping, sweeping. They have a brick wall going up next week that a bunch of them are going to work for a dollar a day to build this facility up. There's a lot of people here that's mistreated. There's maybe one or two people that speak the language here out of everybody. And, they're cussed at. Not all officers are bad, but a bunch of them are. I was threatened to get beat up a couple of times. Officer West, he asked another officer to come over there and to back him up. But I stepped back into the room and I told him to come into the room. That way he can be on camera, but he didn't want to. He just made his point and threatened me.
A War on Homelessness or A War on the Homeless by Nick Cooper, excerpted from Free Press Houston. See you, mother, standing on the soap. On March 2nd, Hank Rush, the CEO of Houston's Star of Hope Mission, who makes $250,000 a year salary for his work with the poor, joined several other homeless service leaders in signing a commentary in the Houston Chronicle. They gave their support to a new law that would impose $2,000 fines on unpaid volunteers for sharing home-cooked food with the needy in public. going so far as to criminalize bringing a box of fruit into one's house to keep it out of a hot car for a few hours before going to share it, the law would have been laughable if it weren't a threat to the food supply of a vulnerable population. Wondering why homeless service providers might consider supporting a law that was so potentially devastating to Houston's homeless population, activists began researching Star of Hope. The first news item that came up was that Mayor Anise Parker had announced a massive public-private partnership with the Star of Hope just 4 days before the commentary was published. $3 million initially, and $1.5 million per year thereafter was planned for a sobering center for people found drunk in public. Touted as a cheaper and less punitive alternative to incarceration, the project would benefit Rush and other signatories to the commentary. The mayor said, quote, "I perceive this ordinance as trying to balance the rights and needs of different groups of people." Apparently for her, the homeless are the ones holding the upper hand in this imbalance, and the victims, the downtown business owners, require the city's emergency help. The need of property owners is being trampled by the need of the homeless to eat, sleep, and excrete. She compelled the city to act urgently to control trash and excrement not by putting out more receptacles and toilets, but by policing the food supply. Massive backlash from volunteers of all stripes forced the mayor to change the law, stripping it of important details. It no longer explicitly criminalized things like the sharing of homemade food, but since the process for obtaining permission was never disclosed, it was anyone's guess what the criteria she or subsequent mayors might choose to use for granting permission. Homemade food might be illegal, it might not. It just depended on the unwritten criteria of whatever agency has the job of granting permission.
Mayor, as you may not be aware, some council members may not be aware, I was homeless from 92 to 98, and I utilized many, many people that helped me out with many meals over a six-year period. A number of individuals are here today that will speak. I literally would not have survived without so many people that had the unrestricted ability to feed me. And I wanted to come here today because I want this in the minutes. I want Ann Russell to put this in the minutes. Mayor, you've let me down.
Okay, there are.
My name is Manuel Sanchez, and I'm outreach coordinator and on staff at Ecclesia Church. And I did have a few moments to look over the press release, and we're still opposed to any type of asking for permission on public property to go ahead and feed. If we feel that we're led by the Spirit to help out individuals who are needy and in need, or really do just want to extend our love and our hand of friendship, that we should be able to without actually asking for permission. I appreciate everything that you guys have done to go ahead and address some of the issues, but still asking for permission on public property to go ahead and feed still isn't, it doesn't really stand up to what we stand for.
I'm also speaking on behalf of the proposed amendment to Chapter 20. Let's protect these uncoordinated and volunteer staff feeding of the hungry. I'm so very proud of my 20-year-old daughter who's been involved with this for 2 years. I just stepped up to the plate based on her respect and her validation of these people. Every day we make choices to take or give, to hate or love, to dishonor, to ignore, or to look away. She and her friends choose to validate and respect. I know there are issues. If trash is an issue, we've got ordinance for that. Let's take care of the trash. If we're on private property, let's take care of that. But let's address the need of feeding the hungry and doing what we do best. Let Houston be the leader in this. I know there's lots of states that are going through this. Let's set an example for this charitable service. Thank you.
I think that this is a violation of religious expression, freedom of assembly, equal protection under the law, and I'm not an attorney, but I think as an American citizen, as a Houstonian who loves all of mankind, that this definitely dehumanizes people, and we need to be able to feed hungry people when we see them, whether they're 5, 6, 1, 2, or 100. If we have the means, we're called to do that. If we see our brother and sister in need, and we have material possessions and we don't help them, how can the love of God reside in our hearts?
Mayor Parker, City Council, thank you for allowing me to speak here. I just wanted to join the chorus of voices you see here today objecting to this proposed amendment, imposing any sort of limitations on sharing food with people. Even with the five-person limit on there, I still think it's too broad, and it could be construed to cover perfectly acceptable activities like picnics and whatnot. And just even at a more basic level, I think it's unjust to tell anybody that they're not allowed to share food with people.
The Houston port is one of the largest in the nation, if not the largest. And so it was going to be impossible for us to actually shut down the whole port. But what we decided to do was to block a road symbolically, so that way we could stand in solidarity with what was happening in California. But it actually was not just Austin occupiers. There were occupiers from Dallas and Houston, who also locked down. So there were 7 people in total who locked down. There were 20 people in total who were arrested. There's a number of folks from the National Lawyers Guild who are helping represent everyone who was arrested that day. You don't need pipes to block a road, because there were a number of other folks who got arrested simply by locking arms. So it's not the type of crime that you need those devices, but those devices were used, and so it appears that the district attorney is promoting the amplification of the crime through the use of these instruments, and it's a new type of thing. It's a new type of interpretation of that law.
Okay, now we only have about 2 minutes left. Can you maybe talk a little bit about those Texas activists that continue to face felony charges as a result of their nonviolent direct action civil disobedience?
There will be 3 of us that will be facing trial by jury on June the 18th. The charges that we're facing are up to 2 years in jail. that's sort of a maximum penalty. There's a potential of a fine involved as well, but. But the folks involved with the felonies are looking at about 2 years in jail, and then being charged with a felony in relation to a nonviolent civil disobedience protest.
So anyway, wanted to say a couple things about October 22nd. It's the National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, the Criminalization of a Generation. And this October needs to be a day marked by varied forms of determined resistance that bring together those who bear the brunt of the brutality and murder this system enforces on the oppressed, with people throughout society who don't want to live in a society where people face this kind of injustice because of the color of their skin or because of the country of their origin. And, you know, a few people mentioned this is a smaller grouping than we've had in other years, but this banner is very important. There are many people throughout this city, as well as throughout this country, who are with us today. People signed this. It says mass incarceration plus silence equals slow genocide. People in Third Ward who are directly under the gun of this system, you know, signed this. People today on the University of Houston campus came up and signed this. People at the jails who have people languishing in those jails, sometimes for a year and more without even charges, let alone a trial, signed this banner. And I think it's very important that we see that.
Texas Avenue. I'm here with Cassie Bruce, protesting the Trans-Canada Pipeline. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you're here, who you are, what you're doing?
Well, there's a lot of causes that I'm interested in. This one really got my attention as far as choosing your battles, because I just bought land in Oklahoma that's about 40 miles away from the existing pipeline, or the pipeline they're also extending. So this is really an easy battle for me to choose because it's literally hitting really close to home. What it means for property owners is eminent domain is being used under the pretense of providing public infrastructure. But what they're doing is they're taking away private landowners' land. And they're not doing it under any of the guidelines that are supposed to be used. For example, they're supposed to be a common carrier to take advantage of eminent domain. And they have not done any of the things they're supposed to do to prove that they're a common carrier at all. They're violating the law. They're violating people's constitutional rights to land ownership. It's eminent domain being used for private gain, which is not what it was ever intended to be used for.
Would you like to talk a little bit about what the XL pipeline is going to mean for Houstonians and why you as a Houstonian feel that this is something that you need to get behind and stop?
Well, Houston is in a unique position in that we have a lot of culpability on this issue. While we are one of the few places that stands to gain, to have some material gain from it, it will come at the immediate cost of the families that live in the refinery area, which is a community of color, and who will suffer an increase in child mortality rates, cancers, and general blight on their neighborhoods and communities. But we will be profiting, to the extent that anyone does, from oil that, as admitted by the EPA, they don't know how to clean, and has already polluted the Kalamazoo River. We would be the beneficiaries of a plan to clear-cut rainforest up in Canada, polluting the waters and destroying the ancestral homelands of the First Peoples there in Canada. Then we would be benefiting from the farmers who have their land stolen through misuse of eminent domain or by legal threats, so that the pipeline can run through their property at a song to, again, pass those savings on to people who are just going to pass this oil through Houston's port and the port of Port Arthur so it can be sold abroad. So this is the essence of acting locally while thinking globally. We are benefiting from things that are immoral for us to benefit from, and it will actually only harm us as well to take part in this system.
So, do you want to talk a little bit about, I know TransCanada has talked a lot about how this is going to create jobs, it's going to reduce oil prices. Do you want to talk a little bit about what this means for the port? This is essentially, it's going to be exported out of Houston to go overseas, correct?
Yes, that's correct. That's part of why it's very important to them to bring instead of networking it from other places in the United States or building refineries there in Cushing, Oklahoma, it's very important for them to bring it here to the Gulf Coast, not just for the refineries that already exist, but because we are major shipping points. Port Arthur actually has a loophole where you are exempted from excise taxes for international transport that I'm sure they're planning on taking advantage of. So that way, in fact, yes, TransCanada is using this pipeline as a way to avoid some of the royalty fees they would otherwise have to pay to move this oil into U.S. markets and then through it, just to take advantage of our already built infrastructure.
So basically it sounds like a foreign corporation, TransCanada, is trying to utilize American infrastructure so that they can make profit abroad.
Yes, I mean, TransCanada is definitely an international corporation, but part of how it has any anchors in Houston is by buying up Texas companies and slapping its name on them, and therefore to have it through. In fact, when you Google TransCanada Houston headquarters, you will see 717 Texas, but you will also see ANRE Energy, because that's who was here that they then bought 3 years ago so they could have a holding here to organize the pipeline. Cornell University's Department of Global Labor Studies did a specific study about the job impact of TransCanada, and not only did it debunk thoroughly the thousands and millions of jobs would be made, but they put forward it may actually have a net negative impact on jobs, because it will, by shipping the gas that's been allowed to accumulate out of Cushing, Oklahoma, it will raise gas prices in the middle of the United States, where jobs are based through agriculture and shipping, all of which are heavily influenced by the price of diesel fuel. So you will actually have an increase in prices, not only exacerbated by the drought, causing economic harm in the heartland of the United States, which will make up for the permanent jobs that will be gained here in the Gulf Coast area for refinery, and then of course all the construction jobs will be temporary despite their claims. They also made a specific aside in their report, they could find no evidence backing up the idea that it would have a positive environmental income or encourage independence from global foreign oil sources. So yeah, I recommend the Cornell University report highly to everyone.
We only have so much clean groundwater. The pipeline runs through multiple aquifers that serve millions of people with water. So eventually, no matter where you live, it's going to affect you.
For more information about Tar Sands Blockade Houston, visit facebook.com/TarSandsBlockadeHTX. And to keep updated about the international movements, go to tarsandsblockade.org.